Hey, Doug. I figured you, wherever I hear cow's voice, Doug's not far behind. No, it's melting really well. I mean, since last Sunday when it started till now, it was the roads are perfect out here now, and it's been very, very mild.
Well, that's great. How much did you end up getting?
I would say average about 18 inches. You know, there were drifts that, brought it down to like nothing in certain spots. So, like, lawn was showing one because there was a lot of wind. So that's what happens. You get the wind is blowing one way and the whole time, so it doesn't allow the snow to settle in one spot where, but when there's no wind, that's where it all collects, and it's really high drifts.
Yeah.
So I'm ready for the spring. So I was looking over, listening over, I mean. So the previous, we did a couple of classes before we detoured into the whole area of damages, but we did a number of classes on this section, so I was just going back just to refresh myself on it. And we're back in Kehelis, chapter 7, and we're on verse 25. So just to get us back into it, so we noticed that the King Solomon was attempting to understand the right path for man in order to achieve happiness. And he was trying to go back to the beginning. He felt that the first step was to try to really gain a lot of wisdom. And but before that, he even said, "Don't be a person's happiness should not be dependent upon the social sphere." That's why he said, "If you hear your workers cursing you, don't take it to heart, because even you at times cursed others." Meaning, it's something which you should have grounds to forgive. It also should not be something which occupies your attention. And he starts with that because that is one of the strongest emotions, is the social sphere. People are always very concerned with that. What others say, in the person, in my personal fame, in my status with others, how am I viewed, and all these things are really just a barometer, but it's a fantasy because you don't even know the facts. And a person can get so bent out of shape or spend so much energy and time and money in life based on what he thinks will be what other people think of him. So you see how it's a... It can really be very damaging. It's not even based in reality. The person just assumes. But since he hears so many people, what occupies their speech is their preoccupation with others and what did he say and what did she say and who was honored at the dinner and so on and so forth. So when a person hears this, he doesn't stop to question whether or not it's a worthwhile pursuit. He just automatically follows this because it's everybody's doing it. Therefore, there has to be a value to it. So this is something which King Solomon is saying, that we have to be careful not to fall into that trap. Not to seek positions of domination over others, of leadership. The rabbis say, it says you should hate the rabbinate, meaning it should not be something which a person is going after. If you take a look, I put in the Jewish Times this week, Rabbi Chade's beautiful article on Sins of the Leaders, where he talks about how the great leaders in Judaism, all the way up to Moses, they shunned the spotlight. They didn't want it. And he says the mark of a bad leader is somebody who does want leadership, because that's really an expression of ego. And he says you can detect it. It doesn't take too long to detect in a person who's a poor leader, where he starts talking and it starts becoming about him and not about God, or not about the welfare of the people. So, if some come out so transparently, like Obama, when he was running for president, and he kept on saying the lines, "It's not about me, it's about you." Evidently, that was something which he sensed would be something that would be distasteful, that people see a person going after leadership for himself. So he does a very transparent thing. He says, no, it's not about me, it's about you. Like, it couldn't be more transparent that's exactly what it was. Because why does that have to be part of his speech if it's not even part of his, it's not even on his radar, it should not have been part of his content at all. The fact that it was part of his content means he was very conscious of the emotion. So that's a telltale sign. It's just the opposite is true. So that's something which a person should not be looking for, the whole social sphere. Of course, you need to have friends, your family. But, you know, a few friends, a few good friends, and then your family should be very sufficient for a person, for inner satisfaction. And then he goes on, and he talks about how he wanted to gain more wisdom in 23, but he said I'll become wise, but it's very distant from me. So there we talked about, you see that there's a certain amount of ego involved. I will become wise. The person is pursuing wisdom that way, so that can't be an area of satisfaction, because there'll never be the ability of the person to look at himself and feel satisfied with what he has in his knowledge compared to what he knows is out there, that he just can't tap because how immense and deep it is. That's why he says further that it's very distant in 7:24, very distant is that which was, which was. And we talked about what do you mean that which was, because it's an expression that King Solomon was going to do to gain knowledge and to understand the best life of man, that he would go back to creation. And as Doug mentioned a few months back, so the reason why we'll go back to the beginning of something is because then you can see the components. And we use the example of a chair, or actually Doug's example was cement. I can look at cement now, but I don't necessarily know the components. If I can go back to when it was being formed, and I see there's a mold that you pour the cement into, and before that I see there's even water that gives it a liquefied quality that allows it to adhere to a mold. A solid can't adhere to a mold. And I see the cement and the sand and there's rocks, and now I can understand. So King Solomon was saying, I too will go back to the beginning, and I'll see how man was created. But he said there's two problems with it. It's a very deep science, plus it's far off in time. And since it has those two hurdles, it was a good attempt, because that is a smart move. It is a good maneuver to go back to the beginning of something. Then you can see how it's being formed. Then you see the ingredients and the processes, and can give you greater knowledge and the intent of the designer. But he wasn't able to do that. So he said that he would then look at the human condition as it is in the current state, because that's all we have. And that was 25. But it's interesting, we didn't really go into the Sforno, so I want to read it again and explain. But as 25 reads, he says, and I returned myself and my heart. So that means there's the self, and there's also the heart, meaning the seat of the emotions. And then Ladas, to know, he's going to do an exploration of the entire human condition, and to examine and seek out answers, seek out wisdom, calculations, and to know the evil of the fool and the foolishness or the idiocy of just a person who just lives a frivolous life. So what we said is that he was trying to understand then all the components of the human being and to see how they mesh what the interaction is between them all. Specifically, he was curious about one basic rule, but it had three expressions. How, on the one hand, a person could have knowledge, and there's the intelligence on one side, but then the emotions usurp that knowledge, which the person was so clear about, and cause the person to falter and go against his knowledge. And what were the three examples? Sforno says, he says, I'm going to look into see the evilness of the evil of foolishness, specifically of the snake, the primordial snake by Adam and Eve. How could it be so cunning, as the verse says, and it wasn't afraid of punishment? How is that? And how is it that the woman, that she had the desire for eating, and she wasn't afraid from the punishment that she even mentioned herself. She told the snake that we're going to die if we eat from this. And how could it be also that the man that he allowed himself to be enticed by the words of the snake, and he became heretical, and he also was enticed to eat from the at the request of his wife, with the danger of the punishment of death. So in all three cases, King Solomon, according to Shwano, is asking, how is it possible that there's this realization that the person has on one hand, and where is the point of departure that the person that can then reject these very clear apprehended warnings about death, the most threatening notions, and yet a person can go against it? So it seems to be from Sforno, it is a very intriguing question, how it works. How does it work that a person in one moment is convinced of the danger of something and is reluctant to violate God's word, and another moment the person's violating and he transgresses? What happens? What's the process? At what point? What is the pivotal point that now can tilt over the person's adherence to the right and then commit the most tragic wrong? It's a very good question. It's hard to even think about how you can dissect, because you know, you're talking about the workings of something which is metaphysical, the mind. You don't see it, you can't put it in front of you at a table. It's like when Freud was about to give a lecture once, he apologized in a certain manner of speaking that he couldn't present the organs of the mind on a table like a physician. And he was talking about psychology, so it was more abstract, and it's more of an uphill battle. So it's the same thing here. I mean, we're trying to understand the very specific point in the workings of a person that he can be convinced of something intelligently and not go against that intelligence, but then at another moment, even within the same day, we say, because we said that they sinned on the same day that they were created. So you see the problem, right?
Is it too simplistic to simply say that's a free will decision of the person?
Well, I mean, I think we know that that's really what is the, the person has the free will. I think what he's asking more is if we can pinpoint what causes the change. At what point in the process, how does the process work even? Yeah.
It seems to me like in the case of death, you know, you will surely die. If they have nothing to relate to, nothing's ever died before, they can hear it, but it's not real to them.
Then she should have acted right away before the snake intervened and beguiled her. If there's no real hurdle, because there's no sense of fear about it, you wouldn't need the snake to egg her on to do it. It would be something internally, right? Something she'd be able to sin on her own. But it seems to be that there was some sort of reluctance. There was a recognition. I mean, again, God can't give a command that's the person is impossible to keep. So they must have been able to keep it, even though they had no idea of good or bad. There was no concept of morality at that point. Yet they did know that is true, that he's the creator, and he created us, and he said not to do this. It seemed to be clear, so they were able to observe it.
What about the idea of focus? So you have this thing around you, and God told you not to do it, okay, fine. And then the snake comes along and says, hey, take a look at this. Let's focus our attention here for a little while. Talk about this thing.
Right, it aroused your desires.
Right.
And as soon as the desires were aroused, that was it. There was no turning back. So you see, the desires had, they were very strong.
So is it a matter of simply choosing what you focus on?
I honestly don't know. It's clear that's the question Swarno's bringing up, and it seems to be also, I think he's on target with, what the intent is, and, King Solomon's words themselves, because, you see all the time that the rabbis dispute as to what the message is of a certain verse, but you see that King Solomon continues when he says that I found worse than death was the sexual desire. That it's entrapping. It's something which, like Ibn Ezra says, he says, I found worse than death a woman, which he says in Ibn Ezra is talking about cheshek, which means the sexual drive. And why does he bring that in now? Because he's talking about the very question. What is it that causes a person to turn away from reality, intelligence, truth? So clearly it's emotion, but he wants to isolate the sexual as being one of the strongest. And that's something which can cause a person to reject even his intelligence. So you see, it seems to be from these two verses that it is Swarno's on target in terms of King Solomon's intent to try to isolate what it is that is causing the person to veer off, and how does it work? He throws in the back to sexual because that's the best example. That's something which a person can identify with, and because he can sense the very strong pull. But I just think that qualifies Swarno's point of what Swarno's understanding. That he's trying to understand how it works. I mean, one point the person, like you're saying, Doug, the person's he's focusing, he sees the reality of something. God tells me not to do this. Now, it seems to be that there is a quantitative type. I mean, a person has a certain X amount of energy, right? And Sforno does talk in Genesis about the way it works. And he says that there's, those famous verses where God talks to the snake, and it says, man will crush your head, but you'll bite man in the heel. And we talked about this a few times. And Sforno really means to say is that man will step on the snake's head in the instincts. He'll be able to conquer the instincts at the head, at the beginning of the battle. So the person feels certain emotions that are swelling up inside of him. And that's where he has the upper hand. He'll be able to stop and pull out right away, changes his thought, his where he is, location, whatever it is that helps him get his head out of that, and he'll have the best chance of fighting the emotion at the beginning of the battle. But if he doesn't, and he gives in, and he lets the emotions start to fantasize more and more, so what happens is the desire becomes greater. So you can look at it like it's you have two buckets in front of you, and they're on a seesaw. And right now, the bucket that's full on the right is the intelligence. But if you start letting some of the water from the right, the bucket that's on the right side, the intelligence, you start pouring into the bucket on the left side, right, the seesaw or the scale or whatever, eventually it's going to equal out. And if you keep on allowing the bucket of water to pour into the left bucket, eventually the left side, the emotion is going to weigh down. And that's what's going to push the action. So the person is going to be driven by where the energies are going. So he can control the energies, but they're easier to control at the beginning of the battle, at the head. So it seems to be that there's a quantitative mannerism of how the emotions or the energies shift. And there's a couple of things that come into play. Because if a person is... he starts giving in. He has a certain fantasy, right? And he starts giving into it, and the energy starts going into that area, and it starts removing from the intelligence. So he will start. He'll still know about the intelligence. He's not completely blind, He has memory. He knows what he was just allegiant to up to this point. But that's it. You have faculties of rationalization and justification, things of that nature. They come into play in a person, like we said also a couple of weeks ago. Rabbi Chait mentioned there's the reality principle that a person can never do something that he honestly thinks is harmful to himself. He always has to be convinced that what he's doing now is good for me somehow, even though it'll be a twisted calculation. This is the last time I'll do it. You know, that's one of the famous ones. Or, well, you know, I'm not Superman, so I can't control myself. That's another one. And the person will be able to accept his shortcomings and his transgressions by first justifying what he's about to do. The person can't justify it, he won't do it. Certainly if the person has a certain amount of momentum behind them. Like the rabbis say, one mitzvah generates another mitzvah, and one sin generates another sin, meaning that the more the energies are going into a certain area, the stronger you become attached to that area. And God said he said to Abraham to do circumcision, to perform circumcision. I think the Ibn Ezra there says that which is complete is very complete. So it's like a very enigmatic statement. Something which is complete, that's it, it's complete. What do you mean something which is complete is very complete? I believe his point is there is that if a person is behaving 100% properly, he is going to have a stronger attachment to it than somebody who's only doing it 99%. Because the fact that he's now perfect and he's keeping everything perfectly, that attachment to it, he also doesn't want to veer from that. There's an additional component that he wants to stay perfectly in line. It's not just that he is doing everything properly, but he's now in a state where he's doing 100% properly. And that's something which, you know, it's easier to go from 99 to 98 than to go from 100 to 99%. It's like, you know, the person who's not smoking at all. So they have that strength that I didn't do it, I didn't break it, I'm still, you know, a quitter. The person who smokes one cigarette, then it's easier to have a second one. But to make that first cigarette, to make that first jump and have that first cigarette, it's harder. So you see how the energies work, that they do have and the certain self-image involved in that case. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be a, you know, somebody who can't quit. So the self-image, that's also, that could be a helpful self-image at that point. But you see there is a, it works, as Sforno says in Genesis, there's a certain way that it works, a certain quantity of energy. And if it starts spilling over to the wrong area, then it gets heavier and heavier, and it's harder to resist. And then all the person sees is, yeah, let me just have that desire, and let me just satisfy it. Because he's living in the moment. That's another thing that happens. The moment becomes very, very powerful. Whereas the rabbis say in Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avos, who is a wise man? One who knows the outcome of his actions. So a wise person is not somebody who's impulsive or has a very myopic view about things and just assesses something based on the here and now without looking at any repercussions. The intelligent person is going to see, well, if I do this, what's going to happen down the road? And he's able to control his emotions and his actions based on what he sees as really the ultimate good for him, not the momentary good. So this, again, you know, King Solomon is pondering here, how does it work? How does it work that these three individuals, the snake, the woman, and the man, they all had certain recognition at one point, but then at another point, they were able to go against it. Is there a specific point of departure that we can isolate? Or is it no more of a continuum? It takes a certain amount of time, and there's justification going on, so it's a number of things that contribute. But is there is a certain point where the person does make the decision to do it. So he is right. I mean, the person does have to decide, yes, I'm going to transgress. And then he acts. What gets him to that ability? What gets him to that point? It could be like we're saying. I'm just talking out loud. Is if there's something specific we can put our finger on.
Rabbi, if we go back to the story of Adam and Chava, isn't there a point in the text where the snake approaches her, and then the next part says, and she saw that the tree was good?
Right.
In other words, there's a turn to focus on it. I mean, she knew it was there before, because they'd been given the commandment before. But he starts talking it up, the snake starts talking it up, and she turns and looks at it and makes either some kind of analysis in her own mind or focuses her attention there.
Right. She says it's good also. She actually gives an evaluation that this is, and not good morality, but it's, because you could say, if they had no between good and evil yet, how could she make the statement that it was tov, that it was good? So it must mean, let me just see what Uncle says. One second. See, the rabbis also have a medrash on this, and they say that the snake pushed her into the tree. And that's why, because they're trying to account for why she added something on it. She said that we can't touch it. And God never said not to touch it. You see...
Rabbi?
Yes?
I'm sorry to bother you, but that's the measures that I remember learning. The rabbi had said that the snake pushed her into the tree, and once she saw that nothing happened to her, that she was pushed, that she did touch it, she told Adam, and that made it seem to be okay, because it was proof positive in her mind that, look, I touched it and nothing happened to me, so you could touch it too, and whatever, and then the progression was continued. That they took from it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the rabbis were wondering about, is why does she add on in verse 3:3 that you can't touch it, and she also said maybe we'll die. See, there's two things that she did. So they're trying to say, oh, it must have been that the rabbis make a famous statement on this. They say anybody who adds detracts. So she added on a taboo. Like, people think that, you know, pig is disgusting just because it's not kosher. So they're adding on a taboo which is not necessary. So she did the same thing. Once she was aware that this tree was prohibited to eating, you know, to eat of it, so she also added on, oh, there must be something inherently bad about the tree, and you can't even touch it too. So, but you have to look into this a little bit more. See, she said, sure. There was a denial. Well, what's that?
Yes, absolutely, because I remember the rabbi was speaking about it, and once she was able to touch it, again, I'm repeating, then it proved that touching was okay. But where is it written that you're not supposed to touch?
Right, it's not. She added that.
Right.
That was her own problem, but the question is now, so what's the importance of the Torah telling us that we can't touch it and maybe we'll die? And then she goes on, and the snake says that, no, you're not going to die, and the snake gives her a rationalization that God knows, and the day that you eat from it, you can actually, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God, you'll know good and evil. So then you see the verse 6 where it says the woman saw, this is what you were quoting, Doug, that the tree was good to eat, and there was a desire to the eyes, and she desired the tree to become wise. So you see that she had to go through a state of, first of all, denial. Maybe we'll die. So in order, I mean, it's good that you brought it up, Doug, because this isolates what the steps were in terms of moving to, so there had to be a certain amount of denial. But that came from a mistake, that she says that we can't touch it. And only maybe. She mitigated. Maybe she would have said, maybe we'll die also, even without the adding on of the touching. Maybe she just would have said, maybe we'll die. Meaning she heard you're going to die, but look, she, you know, with time a person can mitigate the severity of something. It allows, you know, as time marches on, it becomes less and less severe, less potent for some reason. Now, but there also had to be not just the denial of the command, but there had to be something which was a justification that she wanted to do it. That's verses, that's verse 6. Okay. So, let's just see. It seems that as soon as she saw that there was a denial of the threat and there was something positive to be gained, and it wasn't just one positive, you see. It was a number of things. That she saw that the tree was good. It also had to appeal to her intelligently, because she also says that, and it was desirous of the tree to become wise. So these were not just base individuals, you know, Adam and Chava. But there had to be something where she catered to the intelligent part of herself too. Perhaps something too base. It would be too low for a person, and they couldn't stand that about themselves if they just did something very vile and very, you know, degenerate. So it couldn't just be, you know, the physical desire. There had to also be this element of it appealed somehow intelligently. It had that appeal to that part of the self. But there was no stopping. Once there was desire, then it worked on her. But it also seems, though, at the beginning, it was instigated by the snake, something external to her. Whereas we say today that now, back in at that time, all the desires were only externally stimulated. Until Adam saw his wife, so the desire for sex wasn't there. He was naturally drawn towards wisdom. That's why he was naming animals. But after the sin, the fantasy is now internalized. So a person can have fantasy without having any initial external stimulus. So which is it's a worse state. Okay. So can we look at these verses here and see at what point, what's the pivotal point?
You're talking about the verses of Genesis?
Yes.
Rabbi, to me it seems to be when she misquotes God, because her lack of understanding is what's going to lead to her undoing here. And I think that's why Torah links her to the foolishness in 7:25 of Kohelet.
What was the last part?
And that's why I think that Torah links her to the foolishness of verse 25 in Kohelet, is because her lack of understanding is what undoes her.
The lack of understanding.
Yeah, you said that, you know, she had put a taboo in there that wasn't there. So when the taboo proved to be false, because she didn't actually understand the command right, it was easy to negate the entire commandment. It was because of her bad understanding that she sinned.
Right. Are you going to say that it applies to the snake and to Adam too?
No, but I'm saying that's why the Sforno links her to the foolishness, and then the madness he applies to Adam, right, and the wickedness of folly to the snake. So they seem to have different motivations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this So what was the snake? The evil, right. So the snake was evil, the evil of the fool, and the woman, it was the sickest. It was the foolishness of Chava. Syphilis or Chava. Right, so the snake committed towards evil. And the woman because of foolishness. And what was man's sin? That's a good observation to make, Jim. Because he's saying he's attaching the sin of each one of these individuals to another verse, another word in that verse in Kehelis. Yeah, I didn't pick up on that. That's good. That's a very good observation. And he says what? He says that Halelus shall Adam, the frivolity of man. Shinifta the Dibra Hanahash. He allowed himself to be enticed to the words of the snake, which actually were echoed by Eve. Right?
And could it be that the evil, or we use the term evil here, although I don't think that shows up in the Genesis account, but I wonder if it's her emotions, that she's allowed her emotions to overpower her intellect, because it would seem if the serpent came along and, you know, said, you won't surely die, and a person was operating from their cognitive faculty, they'd do an investigation and look at, well, let's see, let me think about it. What exactly did God say? You know, what are you saying? What's the difference? And so forth. But the desire for the tree overcame her thinking faculty.
Right. But he's, like Jim is correctly saying, that he's attaching the error of each individual, the snake, the woman, and man, to different capacities of the psyche. And he's not saying it's the foolishness of the snake, he's saying it's the wickedness of that snake. Because he was not, he was the one that instigated it, the snake. So there was
When you say wickedness, how would we define wickedness in this context?
Going against the Creator. He was aware of the snake, he was aware of the command. And yet he beguiled those who were commanded not to eat it. And we're understanding the snake as being something that had intelligence, was able to speak. Not euphemistic, it's not a metaphor. There's some God could make a being that has this type of a design. And it was the evil that was promoting it. Whereas the woman, it wasn't the evil, but there was a foolishness. And he's trying to understand again that how these different capacities can cause a person to veer off. One person could veer off the truth because an evil motive. Another person could veer off the truth because of some foolishness. Right? She wasn't clear about the command. And she added on. She says, you can't touch it. So that we could see more readily. That type of a foolishness, that error, can cause a person to be misled. Whereas Adam was being driven away by enticement of the woman. There was an enticing emotion going over there. There was something that he wanted. And that wasn't because of an error, but because some other emotion took over. Tina, you're asking, but weren't Adam and Chava wise people? How couldn't she know that what the commandment meant? Evidently, they're not, you know, free from mistake, though. Of course, they were very perfect people. They were God's perfect creations, perfect intellects. But that does not mean that the human being is flawless in any way. As a matter of fact, the Talmud that talks about the four people who never sinned, Adam is not one of them. And clearly we know that he sinned. So that means that there's an error on his part. But you see more clearly now that a person could veer off from the truth based on an emotion that it captivates him and he's enticed by it. And the sensation, the feeling of good that this can afford me, and the justification, like we see very clearly spelled out in Eve's her words. It spells out exactly. She had to go through some sort of a justification. She couldn't just immediately sin. That's not how the human being is wired. So there had to be some denial that mitigates the negative, but there still had to be some positive. But you see, the positive is much stronger. And you see, it talks about that the woman saw that the tree was good to eat, and it was beautiful to the eyes, and it was desirous to become wise. So there's many more factors that were pulling her towards violation than remaining true to the command. So it could be that's what it's illustrating. That it does work where it's like the analogy we gave of a certain amount of energy, and you have two buckets on either side of the scale. And you put the energy, you pour from one bucket into the other, that's it. It's gonna outweigh, and that's where the energies are going to be attached to. So greater energy is, and that's the sforno too. If a person allows himself to go with the emotion and the fantasy, so eventually, if he doesn't fight the emotion at the beginning, when it first swells up, so then it'll overtake him. The snake will bite man in the heel, meaning that the instincts will get man at the end of the battle. That will always happen. He'll just become too strong. The desire will just become too strong, and his sense for reality is just he's not putting energy into that sense of reality. So there's only a certain amount, there's a certain point where the energies are going more into the emotion, and the sense of reality just does not play as real on his mind. There's his clear thinking, because you only have a certain amount of energy. You can't be intensely involved in an emotion and intensely attached to the truth at the same moment. It's one or the other. And there is a point of where it shifts. And that seems to be what, you know, King Solomon was getting at. Where is it? At what point could it be that they had realization, but at a certain point that they denied the realization of truth, and they were all three were able to sin. All for different reasons. Yeah, I think he goes on and he qualifies when he says in 28, where he says that I sought out, but I could find maybe one man in 1,000 that could live properly, but a woman, even 1 in 1,000, I couldn't find. So he's trying to show how it's a very rare finding. So we'll have to see how the verses continue. But you see, it continues on this theme.
So is he saying that women sin more often than men?
It seems to be that the emotional makeup is stronger in a woman. Seems to be, that's what he's saying. It's a cryptic verse. I'm still working on that myself.
Okay.
There's a couple of different explanations on it. You want to take a look at Sforno, Rashi, Ben Ezra? I want to see how this series of verses unfolds. Right now I'm satisfied where I see how he goes from this verse about the comparison of the Quintus Sforno, the snake, and Chava and Adam, and then he moves on and he talks about the sexual, because he's trying to illustrate the most powerful of the urges that's going to hurt a person. But then how does he move from there to verse 27? And we have to just get the facts what 27 means. So I still have to work on myself. You see, he saw it as a puzzling thing. He saw this transition of a person being clearly, you know, viewing the truth, but then being able to ignore that and then actually sin. How does that work? So he was, of course, King Solomon was not saying it's impossible. People sin all the time. And that's what his findings, you know, showed him. But he was more curious about how. What's the mechanism? And interesting also that Ibn Ezra says in 25, when he says that I returned, he says, I turned all my thoughts in my heart to know what would happen if I allow my energies to flow both to wisdom with the evil and of, you know, of foolishness and just frivolity. What would happen if I allow all the entire personality to mix? Because again, he was trying to study the human condition to see how the interaction is between the various components of the psyche. So that's what Ibn Ezra says he was doing here. And that's why, you know, Sworn also follows through there. You see that there's intelligence, but there's also frivolity, there's evil, there's foolishness, and what's the interplay in terms of the practical steps that the person takes? What causes the person to move in a certain direction? I mean, he was in square one, that was in square eight. How did he get there? Now, of course, we know this is all completely in our control. But there's varying forces that are going on internally. Okay, so maybe we'll have to do it now is look at the next few verses for next week and see if you look at the commentaries that you can get on it. So that is 27 and 28. And 29. You see, even though we don't go by the English chapters, but it does look like a new point where chapter 8 starts, and it starts talking about who is like a wise man, who can understand the explanation of a matter. So he seems to be moving on to a praise of the intelligent person. So what we have to do is go through 27, 28, and 29, the last three verses in chapter 7. And see if we can see where he's moving in terms of you know, his process of thinking over here. All right, is there any questions, though, before we wrap it up?
I think you're good here.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Should we assume what the problem it's still not certain yet. What occurred with the problem is it was because she touched the tree that made it continue. We don't know what he said. Is that true?
Well, when the rabbis were saying that the snake pushed her into it, it's because they were trying to explain something. That when she said that we can't touch it, so this is something that she said openly. So in order for the snake to get her, so he had to start mitigating the gravity of the threat. And he saw an opening. Right there he saw an opening. She added onto it. He knew, the snake knew that you could touch it. There's no problem touching it. So he used that as an inroad to get her, because he knew that if you could mitigate the severity of something, then that's the first step towards getting them across and making them violate.
This is how I learned it. But I wasn't sure if I should continue, if there was something more that was to it.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll pick up next week, everybody. Have a good week.
All right, everybody. Thanks. You have a good week, too.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Everybody, happy New Year.